This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to The Morning Run on BFM 89.9, the business station. I'm Melissa Idris. Great to be back with you after the weekend. Also here with me, Julian Ng and Sherrod Kutten.
Good morning,
gentlemen.
Good morning.
Did you have a good weekend?
I had a very good weekend. Spent part lazing around and part working very hard.
Ooh, okay, nice mix. Very good.
So you neutralize your weekend by like lazing around and working hard.
Well,
like
actually, I worked hard first all of Saturday. I cooked, ate, and drank myself scentless, and then
nice.
And I had something
Thanks
called.
Thanks for the invitation.
Have you ever tried something called? Oh, sorry. Well, you know, not all of us can be on the A list.
Yeah.
Ooh. Burn. You know what a mud bug is?
No.
Have you ever tried that?
I'm glad I wasn't invited.
Do I want to know what that is?
That's Sherrod. Like crayfish, but it's called mud bug. It looks like a bug or something.
Are they from Australia?
I don't know, but they're actually farmed in Johor.
Right. Okay. Okay. So there you go. A day, a weekend of good food, I see, for you, Sherrod. Very nice. But today, Monday, the 27th of June, stay with us this morning as we'll bring you interviews and news analysis between now and 10 o'clock. On the Breakfast Grill today, we've got the chairman of the General Insurance Association of Malaysia, PIAM, Anthony Lee. Julian, you're going to be speaking to him. And I guess quite an interesting time at the moment. PIAM, they are trying to be the singular voice for the insurance industry. They want to create a favourable business environment in a overall tough operating macroeconomic outlook.
That's right. I guess there are a lot of forces, market forces, to bring prices down, not least Bank Negara, the regulator of insurance, the insurance industry in Malaysia. They're set to remove general insurance pricing regulation. This means that we will see cheaper general insurance policies. This not only for general insurance, but I guess Bank Negara is also taking steps to free up the life insurance industry by demanding that a lot of these life insurance products are available online and are transparent so that you can go out there and check out what you need at the best price that you can. But today is specifically on the general insurance industry, and a de-tariffication is set to take place.
So is that a good thing that Bank Negara wants to remove this pricing regulation?
Oh, for sure.
But it's like a disruptor to the insurance market, right? So
the
incumbents in the industry, they have to really kind of buck up. It's fintech, essentially, isn't it?
It's kind of fintech, but I guess it's also the fact that you don't need to be, for the general insurance companies, you don't need to be spoon-fed anymore as to what you should charge for your own products. I bet there are many general insurance companies out there that can say to themselves, hey, I have the ability to decide on what price I want to charge. And they might think that the existing prices are unfair to either themselves or to their own customers.
You know, I'm probably one of the few people who has a very jaundiced view of life insurance policies or insurance policies generally, because it seems to me that, you know, and having gone through some of the processes of trying to apply for one, there's so many exceptions and there's so many things that will knock you out, or ambiguities that, I felt that, the company was trying to make sure that they could find a way out of paying me
gaps in coverage.
Yeah, you know, that, you know, or if I didn't say, didn't
report
everything.
So what were you claiming for?
I mean, this was just a life insurance policy,
okay,
and, you know, with some sort of medical benefits, I guess.
Right.
But, you know, for me, it was just I think I might be in the minority in this, you know.
No, you're not.
I'm not? Well, yeah. You know, I think
There are a lot of problems in the insurance industry. And I think claiming is just one of the very small ones. The bigger issue is being overcharged for the policy that you're buying, because the policies are so opaque. We don't understand the language of the policies that are given to us. So a lot of misinformation that's out there that we need to eliminate and get to the bottom of.
Yeah, it seems like you'll get covered for the simplest of things when you in fact want to be covered for the whoopers, you know, and And I think the only real solution to these problems and the high cost of medical care is euthanasia. But, you know, I probably am in a minority.
Okay, that you're probably in the minority there. All right.
Euthanasia is not cheap. You probably have to plan
have
for
good
that.
Friends.
Yeah.
So the insurance industry is on is in focus on the Breakfast Grill today with the chairman of the General Insurance Association of Malaysia, Anthony Lee. After the grill on current affairs, we find out more about the Abu Sayyaf group in southern Philippines and what motivates their criminal activities. Of course, this follows the abduction and release of four Malaysian sailors, also the beheading of the Canadian hostage, and also a state of other violent incidents over the past year involving the Islamist militant group. So today, we're going to be looking into the kidnapping industry of Abu Sayyaf and also the risks that families of hostages face when they pay ransom to the group. So do you remember the case of the 12 million ringgit ransom that was paid and the missing 3 million?
Yes. In fact, I think a lot of Malaysians haven't forgotten that because, again, I think it's just added to a deep distrust with those in authority, especially I think the rather curious response, I think, coming out of the police force, the IGP saying they weren't going to investigate the missing money. I do think that Malaysians expect high levels of, you know, accountability. And in this case, we wait to see if we'll have any.
Well, I'm surprised that, you know, it's an open secret, right? Abu Sayyaf's kidnapping industry. So according to some security analysts, this is a business for them. They know they can make money. This is how they fund their terrorist activities.
Well, it's not surprising. I mean, look, we have had a history right through the 20th century of various groups, you know, when they're small, you know, sticking up a bank is one way of doing it, terrorizing and taxing a community of which you have some sort of a sway. If you have a sway over some territory, you tax them or you rob them. And this is a way in which small militant groups fund themselves, right? Or they have big backers somewhere else. But this is nothing new, I think, in the history of militant activity.
9:35 a.m. Joyce Goh from The Edge is back on Pressing Matters. Are takeover offers a sign of things to come for listed stock brokerages? That is the topic of today's Pressing Matters show. With brokerage commissions thinning and also a bleak macroeconomic outlook, it's a challenging time for the stockbroking houses, because if you look in the past 4 months already, there were 3 takeover exercises launched on companies that are or once were in the stockbroking business. And in all 3 cases, the offer price was very low. So I guess today the question we're asking is this a sign of things to come, more takeovers for the stockbroking business?
If you look at the developments in the United States, you have these so-called discount brokerages where you pay them a fee of $10 or something for a year and they let you have unlimited amounts of trades. So that is the kind of fintech disruption that you're talking about, right? And I guess the barbarians are at the door. A lot for a very long time, people have been saying that the stockbroking industry is a sunset industry. And I guess we are coming closer to that. But still, you have buyers coming at the doors, knocking at the doors to take over. I guess there are two sides of the story. On one side is a sunset industry. And on the other, this could be an asset for some interested people.
Okay, well, more on that topic at 9:35 a.m. on Pressing Matters. But it's coming up to 9 minutes past 6 o'clock. Let's catch up with all the news that you need to know as you start your week. Of course, you've had a weekend, a couple of days now to process the shocking news that that the UK has voted to leave the European Union. But now, just days after that, more than 2.5 million UK residents have signed a petition calling for a second vote. So now lawmakers will have to at least consider a debate on the issue, because British Parliament has to consider any petition posted on its website that has more than 100,000 signatures.
Oh, the American government has a similar kind of process. Well, I guess it comes down to, you know, the, what do they call it? Buyer's remorse. You know, this idea that, you know, you made your choice and then the next morning you think, oops, maybe not. And I did it for all the reasons. And of course, I guess you guys have been reading some of the analysis, some of the very serious analysis, kind of sociological analysis of, you know, voting patterns. But then the others, just people sharing their experience of the vote, right. You know, voting out of anger in protest against an establishment they feel wasn't listening, and then thinking, oops, I didn't really think it was going to go this way. Can we start again,
so,
please?
A few of the analysis that I've been reading over the weekend seem to suggest that this is a failure of democracy. And I don't know how I feel about that, because it seems they seem to say, you know, this referendum with a simple majority outcome is in a small way a reflection of how democracy can fail you, that... the many may not necessarily know what is good. The majority may not necessarily know what is good for all.
Are we going back to the early days of democracy where in Athens at that point in time, not everybody had the vote, right? Had the right to vote.
Yeah. Only slaves and women didn't have
the right. I don't know how I feel about that.
And
how do you people guys who didn't feel have about property.
Well, I think it's a mistaken notion. The problem really is referendums on a single subject like this is a difficult one, because it's such a complex issue. And the question is, when you reach a conclusion like this, yes and no, especially on those margins, how can you really act on it? You know, I mean, we do know that the British government doesn't have to act on it. It's not legally binding. But it would be political death, a suicide rather, for David Cameron and the Conservative Party not to act on it. At the same time, perhaps the whole thing was put together precisely because David Cameron was trying to consolidate power. And of course, people like Boris Johnson, who I believe...
waiting on the sidelines.
Yeah, you know, who lost his job because he fabricated quotes, you know, as a journalist. I mean, this is a man to be trusted deeply, I guess, or not. You know, was pushing for something that, you know, some analysts are saying he didn't even believe in, because what he wanted was to get David Cameron's job. So, I mean, you have, you know, it's all kind of slightly mistaken in a very serious way from the very beginning. Did this, should it have come to this? Should they even put it to a referendum?
Well, you can argue that as a tactical move, David Cameron has made a mistake, because it spelled the death of his political career as Prime Minister. But we really don't know whether this was a right or wrong vote, because some people say this is anti-establishment, and who's to say that they are wrong, right? The EU has only, they argue, benefited the rich, the bankers, and the businesses in the UK. And it really opened the doors to unfettered capitalism. But many in the UK are suffering as a result of Brexit. The English, they feel they are disenfranchised. So the idea of whether this is right or wrong move can only materialize over the long term. We don't know whether this was the right or wrong vote. Right?
Well, yeah. I guess today we're going to get our first reactions after the weekend. We're going to be speaking to several market commentators on the show today on Market Watch. But in other developments back home, Putrajaya is expected to announce a cabinet reshuffle early this week, according to sources who spoke to The Star Online. So Kapit MP Alexander Nantalingi may replace Dato' Sri Douglas Unga Abbas as the Plantation Industries and Commodities Minister. Of course, you remember Unga was appointed one of the three Deputy Sarawak Chief Ministers in the recent state elections. Also, there are two ministerial positions that need to be filled after Tan Sri Idris Jala and Tan Sri Wahid Omar left the minister and the Prime Minister's department post. Also, two deputy ministerial posts need to be filled as well. So we might be seeing a reshuffle, some musical chairs within cabinet this week.
Well, you know, I would take exception to the expression "have to be filled," because we have, by any standard,
that's true, a very bloated cabinet.
Right? So, I mean, India probably has a cabinet smaller than Malaysia's. And so the question is, what is cabinet for? What are cabinet positions for? Is it about running the government, or is it about rewarding political loyalty and electoral success? And there might be a really good reason for that, because we have a consociational coalition type politics where people have to be, you know, rewarded.
Also,
parties have to be rewarded.
Also, on Friday, UMNO Supreme Council unanimously agreed to expel Muhyiddin Yassin and Mukhris Mahathir for their involvement or alleged involvement with the opposition. Dato' Sri Shafi Abdal was also suspended. And there was a press conference yesterday with both Muhyiddin and Mukhris. So we're going to be speaking to Keith Kam from the news desk in about an hour. He was at the press con. And apparently Muhyiddin said that he's weighing a new political platform from which to continue his criticism of the government. But no word yet if it's another political party. We'll have to see. More on this in about an hour's time with Keith Kam from the news desk. 6:15 now. Our discussion continues in just a couple of minutes. So stay tuned. BFM 89.9. Good morning. This is The Morning Run with Sharad, Jillian and me, Melissa. Now, when it comes to smart financial advice, comedian John Oliver seems to be on a roll. Because you remember that medical debt investigation that went viral? Was it earlier this year?
Yeah, he bought over some debt and then he the next thing he forgave those debts.
He did an Oprah Winfrey.
He bought over some like $15 million worth of debt for $60,000?
Yeah. So he spent $60,000 on a show. That's incredible. He has real resources.
Well, you know, it might not be his money. It might be
absolutely. That's what I mean. He's got like, you know, deep pockets backing him.
Well, I'm not surprised that he's very rich as well.
Yeah. I mean, his show is really popular. So Last Week Tonight now has turned its attention from medical debt to now retirement plans. So John Oliver said that with a $24 trillion in retirement assets, 401k plans and other retirement accounts are a potential goldmine for financial services firms.
Yeah, so everybody is... This is all greed and fear, right? You fear that you would not have enough for your retirement. You fear that you're going to be out homeless on the streets with nothing to eat. Don't know where your next meal has come from. So the advisory and the financial services, financial products industries are kind of milking this. And costs are a major factor that takes away from the kind of returns that normal market returns that you get can get for your retirement. So he basically invited one service provider, I think it was John Hancock, who subsequently after the show became very defensive, unsurprisingly. But what they found out was that the costs were just too high.
Right. I mean, I think we're all struggling with this idea of what's going to be the best store of value, right? I mean, money clearly isn't good enough because, you know, one day the pound is worth this and then, you know, the next day it's 90% of what it was worth the day before. And this is because currencies. I mean,
you've got to diversify. You can't just put
buy pounds.
Yes, but you know, the thing is, you know, if you're a small player, what does diversification mean? Right?
Well, diversification is to buy into a bunch of companies that are like Samsung or Apple that have global operations, that so that you don't get affected by the fall in just one currency. You know, if Samsung sells to the whole world and if it's based on demand and a certain rate of price increases per year, you would be put in a very good position.
Right. And so as a principle, that sounds fine. But for all us bit players, what does it really mean, right? So, the old wisdoms, you know, that, you know, you bought property was a gateway of keeping value, you know, or some of my friends believe, you know, buying art, that art is a great investment because it really depends what kind of art you buy.
Right.
But, you know, again, you know, I guess it must be built for many people.
Absolutely.
Trying to figure out how do they make sense of the financial commitments they'll have post work.
So, I mean, it's granted it's a very complex thing, right? So do you think that John Oliver trying to tackle topics like this for essentially, you know, a late night comedy show, a comedy news show, is this in any way groundbreaking? Is it new? Is he attempting something different here?
I think in a way it is very powerful when you use comedy and you use humor or satire to bring out a point, because it makes a very esoteric subject like financial management and investments very accessible to the people when you can laugh about it. If you don't want to watch the whole 20 minutes of that video, you just have to watch the last 3 minutes of the video, and really sums up for you what you need to do about your long-term investment. And it boils down to costs. It's nothing about how much profits or how much loss you can avoid in investments. It's all about how you should reduce costs if you want to buy into a good financial product.
Yeah, perhaps. I mean, I'm not quite sure whether this is a subject that's been taken up before or not, but yeah, using comedy might be a way of attracting people. I think, especially in countries where people have become skeptical of experts and expert opinion, and I think that's what also John Oliver, sort of trades on, right? This increasing suspicion that people who are there to advise you are actually really trying to sell you something.
Well, there was a little bit in that sketch about Susie Orman, the Susie Orman show, and how ridiculous the questions are. People asking, can I afford a Mercedes-Benz? Can I afford to do this? Can I afford to do that? When clearly...
What was that?
An elf
that course. Yeah, elf spotting course.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if that was real, but you know what
no,
is...
No, I definitely don't think that was real.
The thing with the Susie Orman show is that she doesn't just go from the request to the verdict, I deny you or I give you permission, whatever, is that she kind of works out your finances because she asks you how much savings you have. She asks you what other kind of commitments you have and says, well, is this something you want to get to considering all these other things going on in your life? And she makes some quick judgment about it. But there's a process, perhaps a process that a lot of people don't even begin to, to think about when they think about purchasing things on, say, their credit card, and they're not thinking about the interest that they're paying on the credit card. And a lot of people think, well, I'll just pay the minimum. There's a lot of financial illiteracy out there. And I think what her show does is to begin to break some of that down and to reveal some of the deeper processes.
Well, Jules, you mentioned diversification a little bit earlier. Apparently, there's a new study now that has revealed that buying one of those Chanel bags, well, apparently it could be potentially a safer financial bet than buying a house.
Okay, so
is that music to your ears?
That's called an investment.
But it might shock my mother, right? She'll come into the house, she'll rummage around in my cupboard, she'll see a Chanel handbag and she will say, why, son, why?
You can tell
mint
her.
Mint condition, Chanel is still in the box.
You can tell her that according to the experts at the Vintage Handbag Authority Bag Hunter, they have found that in the past 6 years alone, the value of Chanel bags had increased by 70%.
That's still below the S&P 500, which has tripled over the last 6-7 years. But still, in 1955, the retail price of that 255 was about £154. And today, it's about £3,500 before the fall of the pound, of course.
But, Julian, you kind of hit the nail on the head, because the point is, which takes all the pleasure out of owning a Chanel handbag, is that you have to keep it in mint condition, which means you can't take it out of the wrapping. You have to keep it in the box. And you can't show off. Now, how much fun can that be? At least with art, you can put it up on your wall.
Oh.
Well, it's a lot of fun. Okay. It's a lot more fun buying stocks. You can't even use stocks for anything, can you?
you can't even use stocks
to show off. Wear it on your shoulder.
No, this is true. You can't. But, with objects that, ostensibly have multiple purposes.
Okay.
I mean, stocks don't have nobody claimed that they would be pleasurable.
But I like the idea of this kind of alternative investment. Maybe not a Chanel handbag, or apparently Lego is now a very good investment. It's made, it goes
Again,
up in value.
It has to be in mint condition. It's in the box. You can't let your
kids
play with it.
The returns would just be slightly lower if it wasn't in mint condition. Like,
so you
can actually
something.
Restore a Chanel handbag, I suppose. And Birkin apparently provides excellent return, 14% year on year over the past many years.
But your initial cost outlay will be a lot higher, because the Birkin bag could cost anywhere between $10,000 to $200,000. Thank you very much.
Cheaper than an affordable home.
Okay. Coming up to the 6:30 News Bulletin next on BFM 89.9. Good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run with me, Melissa Idris, also Julian Ng and Sharad Kutan. Now, can a filtration system which produces hydrogen-rich alkaline water successfully treat ailments like cancer and diabetes and high blood pressure? Well, according to this article by Malay Mail Online, USM, or University Science Malaysia, and Datuk Siti Nurhaliza Tajuddin seems to think so, but Malaysia's Facebook users disagree, because I think some Facebook users were really unhappy about a promotional poster for this high-quality drinking water called iMizu, which claims to be able to successfully treat 150 types of diseases.
Yeah, okay. So I think part of the controversy is around words and, you know, the associations we make with it, right? So this product, like so many other water products that are filtered or filtered in particular ways or, you know, increase oxygen content or whatever it is, all claim to have some beneficial health, you know, properties, right? And I think this is just no different. It's just that when you say, and this is in the Malay, is it the rawati, you know, boleh merawati, and I think it's just the idea seems to be, it's translated to cure. So then it says, oh, is this misleading?
Is that what it say in Malay?
The rawati.
Okay.
You know, and so I think that the issue really here is the way it's being read. So it's being read as claims that are either exaggerated and, you know, and goes back to again, the question of our universities. Now, if this was endorsed purely by a celebrity, maybe people wouldn't be as upset. I think they're upset because out of Malaysian universities have come. I mean, I'm sure there's been a lot of really good stuff coming out of Malaysian universities. But the ones that make the news often have to do with things like the anti-hysteria kit.
Uh-huh.
As it was noted, the anti-hysteria
kit. It was 800 ringgit.
That's right. It included, I don't know, an egg and some strange
objects. Salt and pepper.
Salt and pepper. Yes. Salt and pepper, very expensive stuff, ingredients, but wasn't utilized during that mass hysteria outbreak in Kelantan so many months ago. So it was like, well, this would have been an excellent opportunity, though maybe the kids could not afford it. But the point is, so this kind of ridicule, I think there's a kind of whole discourse around mocking Malaysian universities for coming up for these bizarre things.
But I am quite upset that Siti Nurhaliza was chosen as a representative. I mean, it's not that she's an authority on health matters. It would be like as if, Sharad, you were mascotting for like a slimming pill on me. To endorse a handbag, right? Why would
or
she...
Or shampoo.
Exactly. Why would she be a health... I mean, I understand her celebrity status.
Yeah, her popularity.
And that she has a lot of following, but she's not even in the league of somebody like Oprah who would really look closely into what exactly they're endorsing.
Endorsing, whether she believes in
it or
not.
We don't know.
Really put that out to the public, right? But what... Now, I went to the website, iMizu's website, and there is really no scientific research that's being put up in the website for the claims.
Okay, so I'm less upset with Siti Nurhaliza promoting this because I think she is, you know, at the end of the day, there are commercial considerations. She is an artist, she's trying to make money. I'm more upset that USM would put this on their website. USM would endorse this. Has it been proven that it can cure 150 different types of ailments and medical conditions?
Well, I mean, I think generally the idea that, you know, anything that's an antioxidant is good and is, perhaps can protect you against, you know, cancers and stuff like that. I mean, but in a general and very vague sense,
but it's,
right?
But it's so misleading. Misleading to the public know better, right?
This goes back to the kind of degree of fraud that exists in the mis-selling of financial products as well, because we seem to want to believe in the supernatural, that there are people out there who can get us super normal returns to give us a very comfortable retirement. This is the same thing. We are looking for immortality, and therefore we place so much reliance and so much weight on something that could give us life extension and some degree of immortality.
Well, okay, we've had people weighing in. We put out a little poll. You know, the question is whether USM and Dato' Siti Nurhaliza are deserving of the negative publicity. But before I go to that, Dr. Fu from Timak Kinta has weighed in. He says, just like anti-vax movement, too much nonsense in healthcare claims need a clampdown on false claims cloaked in pseudoscience. So that's a bit telegraphic in his expression. Steve has come in with, the product name is a ripoff from an established Japanese product. I don't know if that's true, but anyway, that's what Steve says.
But it does give that impression. I mean, if it sounds
like a Japanese product. Yeah. I have to agree with Dr. Fu here. When I first read this article, my immediate reaction was, okay, the vaccination controversy. Because it's as though someone who may not have the full science, an understanding of the full science behind it, is weighing in to give their medical opinion. Now, I would like to know more about USM and Miresco Integrated Syndrome Berhad's research into this, into this iMizu. It's apparently supposed to convert normal tap water into hydrogen-rich alkaline water. What does that even mean?
To be fair, I mean, to be honest, Melissa, if the website included information about research, I wouldn't be able to access it myself. Whether it's there or not, it doesn't help me because I don't know the science.
I spoke to someone over the weekend who is part of academia overall, and said, and he told me that, you know, part of the university's mandate is to help bring to market their research. They've pumped in money through R&D, all the academics spend hours in the lab, but it just stays there. So there's no commercial viability to the research, right? So part of the mandate now is to try and make whatever they've come up with a commercial product.
But that's terrible. I mean,
why is that terrible?
Because you're supposed, as an academic institution, which is publicly funded, to have your research benefit everybody, no matter whether you can pay for it or not.
But you see, the public funding is the area, right? So not necessarily, not all public universities are fully public funded. They need to, they have their own, they need to generate their own income as well.
Well, that is a travesty, isn't it? Because it really perpetuates the idea that education is only for the rich. And then you sell this product to the public and then you perpetuate the idea that health is only for the rich. And I think that bottled water is probably one of the greatest scams of the 20th or 21st century, right? This is something that's available to us naturally. Do we really need to buy some premium bottled water so that we can have good health?
Well, I don't know if that's necessarily true. I mean, we have in the Klang Valley a lot of problems with the quality of water. There's a lot of rust and dirt and the old pipes.
Yeah, but there are very cheap ways of filtering, having your home filtration systems without actually buying into extremely expensive, not to mention a quite risky bottled water, because the toxins in the plastic may actually leak into your water. So people are carrying around in their bags or whatever, plastic bottled water, which they pay 2 to 3 ringgit for, which is ridiculously expensive.
Okay, that might be, but not all of us. I mean, that may be, but not all of us have access to water filtration systems in our homes. I mean, but I think we're kind of like missing the point yet. Again, we're coming back to the controversy, which is about, USM lending its name to a product which makes such grandiose claims, right? I think one of the things that upset people was that the university does in fact say to the person who consumes this that they should go and make their assessments independently, that they should do, the due diligence. And the question was, well, didn't the university itself do the due diligence? And why are they passing the buck?
And why are they promoting it on their website if they don't believe in this product, right? So if it's a collaboration between USM and this company, as well as Siti Nohaliza, if it's a collaboration between all three parties, and the fact that USM as a public university, a tertiary education institution, is promoting this, I think they hold some degree of responsibility. Taking a quick look at our poll, Twitter poll, if you think USM and Siti Nohaliza deserve the negative publicity, 13 people have weighed in, 92% yes, they deserve the negative publicity.
And 8% say no.
Yeah, so quite interesting. I wonder, what do you think? What would you pick in this poll? Do you think they deserve the negative publicity?
Ooh, you're putting me in the spot.
I can say yes. I'm going to answer yes.
I'd like to know a little more because I think part of the issue is the kind of claims that are generally made about health products. They are worded in such a way that the people who make the claims can sort of defend themselves. Well, they're not saying that if you have a cancer and you drink this, the tumor will shrink. And I think in this case, it does seem to suggest that. The banner, at least, that was used seemed to suggest that, which I think makes it a somewhat dubious claim.
Can I just read out the banner? Terbukti merawati 150 penyakit. So, proven to have treated 150 different types of ailments.
Yeah, but I think there's
it's
other.
It's hard to go against other words.
So the same notion gets expressed many different times in many different ways.
So you think it's just semantics? You think it's just
language?
Well,
I think they were not careful enough.
Okay, all right, there you go. Well, weigh in. We would love to hear what you think. Our Twitter poll is out there. Mizu water controversy. Do you think that USM and Siti Nurhaliza deserve the negative publicity? We want to know what you think. You've got a day to go, but we'll wait. We'll keep an eye on this and see whether it's moving into which direction is moving. All right. It's now 6:51 a.m. Better Man by Pearl Jam. Next, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.